Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 8. Chapter is entitled Prayers by Queen Kunti. Text 37 through 44. That will primarily focus on text 37. Api Aja Nas Tvam Swa Krite Hita Prabho Jihashasi Swit Sudrido Nujivanaha Yesham Na Chanyad Bhavata Padam Bhujat Parayanam Rajashu Yojitam Spasam Apyadaya Nastvam Swakrite Hita Prabho. Jihashasi Swit Sudrito Nujivinaha. Yesham na chanyan bhavata padam bhujat. Parayana rajasu yojitam hasam. Apyadya nastvam swakrite hita prabho. Jihashasi swit sudrido nujivanaha. Yesham na chanyan bhavata padam bhujat. Parayanam rajasu yojitam hasam. If Adya, today, na, us, tvam, you, swakrita, self-executed, ihita, all duties, prabho, O my Lord, jihashasi, giving up, swit, passively, sudrida, intimate friends, anujivana, living at the mercy of, yesham, of whom, na, nor, cha, and, anyat, anyone else, bhavata, your, padambhujat, from the lotus feet, parayanam, dependent, rajasu, unto the kings, yojita, engaged in, amhasam, enmity. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O my Lord, you have executed all duties yourself. Are you leaving us today, though we are completely dependent on your mercy and have no one else to protect us, now when all kings are at enmity with us? Please repeat. O my Lord, you have executed all duties yourself. Are you leaving us today, though we are completely dependent on your mercy and have no one else to protect us, Now when all kings are at enmity with us? Purport. The Pandavas are most fortunate because with all good luck, they were entirely dependent on the mercy of the Lord. In the material world, to be dependent on the mercy of someone else is the utmost sign of misfortune. But in the case of our transcendental relation with the Lord, it is the most fortunate case when we can live completely dependent on Him. The material disease is due to thinking of becoming independent of everything. But the cruel material nature does not allow us to become independent. The false attempt to become independent of the stringent laws of nature is known as material advancement of experimental knowledge. The whole material world is moving on this false attempt of becoming independent of the laws of nature. Beginning from Ravana, who wanted to prepare a direct staircase to the planets of heaven, down to the present age, they are trying to overcome the laws of nature. They are trying now to approach distant planetary systems by electronic mechanical power. But the highest goal of human civilization is to work hard under the guidance of the Lord and become completely dependent on Him. The highest level, the highest achievement of perfect civilization is to work with valor, but at the same time depend completely on the Lord. The Pandavas were the ideal executors of this standard of civilization. Undoubtedly, they were completely dependent on the goodwill of Lord Sri Krishna, but they were not idle parasites of the Lord. They were all highly qualified, both by personal character and by physical activities. Still, they always looked for the mercy of the Lord because they knew that every living being is dependent by constitutional position. The perfection of life is therefore to become dependent on the will of the Lord instead of becoming falsely independent in the material world. Those who try to become falsely independent of the Lord are called anatta, but without any guardian, whereas those who are completely dependent on the will of the Lord are called sanatta, or those having someone to protect them. Therefore, we must try to be sanatta so that we can always be protected from the unfavorable condition of material existence. By the deluding power of the external material nature, we forget that the material condition of life is the most undesirable perplexity. The Bhagavad Gita therefore directs us, 7:19, that after many, many births, one fortunate person becomes aware of the fact that Vasudeva is all in all, and the best way of leading one's life is to surrender unto Him completely. This is the sign of a Mahatma. All the members of the Pandav family were Mahatmas in household life. Maharaj Yudhisthira was the head of these Mahatmas. And Queen Kunti was the mother. The lessons of the Bhagavad Gita and all the Puranas, specifically the Bhagavat Purana, are therefore inevitably connected with the history of the Pandava Mahatmas. For them, separation from the Lord was just like the separation of a fish from water. Srimati Kunti Devi therefore felt such separation like a thunderbolt, and the whole prayer of the Queen is to try to persuade the Lord to stay with them. After the Battle of Kurukshetra, although the inimical kings were killed, their sons and grandsons were still there to deal with the Pandavas. It's not only the Pandavas who were put into the condition of enmity, but all of us are always in such a condition. And the best way of living is to become completely dependent on the will of the Lord and thereby overcome all difficulties of material existence. Om gena timanandasya gananjana shirakaya chakshur umnitam gena tashmai shi guruve namaha. So Queen Kunti has just finished a whole series of glorifications of the Lord, and also describes how the Lord is imperceptible to most people, except to devotees. Through the process of devotional service, the Lord reveals himself. And now she expresses her greatest fear, and that's that the Lord is going to leave them. So this is a very intimate mood. There's different kinds of separation. When Krishna left the gopis, then there was separation. He wasn't present. But here's a kind of separation before the separation takes place. But it's still that viparlumba, the separation, this mood of separation, which is very intense. For Kunti, she's demonstrated her devotional mood to these prayers. And this particular prayer brings up some very interesting points for us practicing devotees. So I'll key in on some points that sometimes seem to be a little misunderstood within our movement. I'm looking for this section where the Pandavas, some of you have Kindles, where there's a description of the that they proceed with valor. Where is that? Is that at the end? I'm sorry? Two-thirds of the way down? I still don't see it. I'm being bewildered. Yeah. Where? Huh? Okay, somehow the Pandavas, I'm not seeing it. I didn't have the book with me, I had the Kindle. And I didn't, so usually I like make some kind of a mark. Okay, so where? I'm sorry. You got a different pagination than I have. Just give me the book and point it to me. Somehow there I just can't see it. I don't know why I'm being bewildered like this. Such a prominent point. Okay, this is, thank you, Prabhu. It's just proof, you know, of how we're not really the doers. You know, we can't do anything on our own. But the highest goal, this is after a description of how Ravana tried to build a staircase to heaven, and then now people are trying to reach distant planetary systems by mechanical devices. But the highest goal of human civilization is to work hard under the guidance of the Lord and become completely dependent on Him. The highest achievement of perfect civilization is to work with valor, but at the same time depend completely on the Lord. The Pandavas were ideal executors of this standard of civilization. Undoubtedly, they were completely dependent on the goodwill of Lord Krishna, but they were not idle parasites. They were highly qualified, both by personal character and physical activities. Still, they always looked for the mercy of the Lord, because they knew that every living entity, every living being is dependent by constitutional position. So it seems to be quite a difficult thing, I think, for particularly in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, when the devotee starts the practice, to understand this whole concept of humility, you know, and even though one may be, sometimes devotees come with extreme material qualifications. I see this a lot in India now. The recruitment strategies have borne some powerful fruit. You get these men from the IITs in India. These are the kind of the most prestigious, at least technical academic institutions in the world. And they're like the best students in their whole district, you know, out of 500 or half a million people, they're the best. And so they get into IIT, and then somehow or other they take up devotional service. And they're very, very qualified materially. So how is it that a devotee, you know, when he's got so much material qualification, can actually depend on the Lord, have a humble mood? It almost seems, it seems almost inherently contradictory. How do you do it, Maharaj? It's something that we all have to wrestle with. Some of us, you know, we've got different arrayments of borrowed plumes, right? But nevertheless, they're borrowed plumes. So how to maintain the kind of humble and dependent attitude in spite of maybe we have prowess in certain areas? Maybe we're great orators or expert at preaching, or, you know, it was always when I would do Sankirtan and I'd get really good results with it, it was always a challenge to say, well, am I the doer or am I not the doer, you know? And I would really chant my rounds really good, and then somehow other things would start happening. So how to actually have this mood? And it's actually, so essential to the whole process of devotional service. I came across some references from the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, the third volume, fifth chapter, which is entitled Prema, Love for God. And there's a series of verses in the commentaries by Sanatana Goswami and how the root of devotional service is dānya, and that's the supreme support. Now, dānya, Narada Muni in this section describes or defines as, even though one is endowed with all good qualities and very auspicious characteristics, he still feels himself to be incapable and fallen. Now, it would be very easy to feel that way if we didn't have good qualities, if we were a lazy bum, and we did all kinds of nonsense, sinful activities, then it wouldn't be so difficult to, have that kind of mood, you know, like kind of a negative self-image. But here, we've got the intimate associates, the eternal associates of the Lord, Queen Kunti, she's speaking like this. And she's the mother of the Pandavas, a very, very exalted personality, and extremely qualified on a material platform. So how does one actually have this, you know? And the tendency will be within our movement, I've seen this from time to time, where devotees get a little lazy. You know, like Prabhupada makes the point that, you know, the standard that Śrīla Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur set for who should live in an ashram, and Prabhupada would say that this is not a place for lazies and crazies. You know, he's very selective, you know, and this is one of the fortes, you know, of the what's going on with the Indian temples now, like in Chopati and Pune. It's very difficult to even move into the temple unless you have a bachelor's degree. And you know, that may seem a little bit like a mundane discrimination, but there was a time when Prabhupada instructed his leaders in India, don't fill our temples up with village boys. Because he wanted the most qualified people, because he had a very big plan to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world. And he relied very heavily upon the Indian populace to do this. So this strategy of recruiting the cream of the youth of India has become very prominent. You know, and other temples have taken that up. I think Chopati and Pune are the most famous, but they're doing this in Delhi, they're doing it in Chandigarh, all over India. No. And it's producing a very powerful result. And these devotees, somehow or other, because they're so qualified, but because they're trained so well, and because they've very much tried to internalize the understanding that actually Krishna, you know, he's given me certain things to use in his service, then they don't have a prideful mentality, just the contrary. Now, in a subsequent verse, Sanat Goswami describes how one should try his best to cultivate thoughts and words and behavior that are in line with this dānya, this utter humility. And anything that stands in the way of that, one should strictly avoid. So there's a cultivation that goes on internally and with our behavior that supports this formation of humility that's so essential to devotional service. I mean, in the Shishastakam, the one shloka that's probably the most emphasized of any of them is the chinadapi sunichena tororiva sahishnuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. It's actually when we have a humble mood, when we see that we're simply tiny parts and parcels of Krishna, we're actually helpless before the material energy. We can't even find a simple place in a purport, you know, unless the Lord allows us to. We can't even walk properly, you know, unless the Lord allows us to. Everything that we do is actually sanctioned by the Lord. And as we progress in the practice of Krishna consciousness, this is my understanding, the Lord drills this home repetitively, that he's actually the controller. And he'll put us in extremely difficult circumstances to emphasize this point. So when we're put in these difficult circumstances, this is when, you know, there's tremendous growth in this area. This is my understanding. And we know from 10.14.8, which is the Mahavakyam for processing distressful circumstances, that the Lord is specifically coming to us to help us. Tatenu kampam shukshamikshamano bunjane vatma kritam vipakam. Red Vag Vapabir Vidadan Namaste Jiveta Yo Mukti Pade Sadaya Bhak. So there's very powerful purporting there in the Gopi Prandan, you know, citing the previous acharyas. And he references the fourth canto. The acharyas reference the fourth canto where Lord Vishnu comes into the arena of sacrifice of Pitamanash. And there's a purport where Prabhupada describes that the devotee is just like a child in his relationship with his father. And he has complete trust in his father. Sometimes his father is very affectionate, embraces him, gives him a ladu, reciprocates with his good behavior. And sometimes the father, you know, really heavily chastises him. But the son remains faithful and maintains this trustful attitude towards the father that he's acting in his best interest. So, I mean, you look at the life of the Pandavas and Queen Kunti, what they went through. My God, you know, I mean, one thing after another. But we can understand from one of the previous prayers that Queen Kunti took this in the right mood. Vipada shantuta shashvat tutra tutra jagadguru bhavato darshanam yatcha apunad bhavadarshanam. She wanted the calamities to happen again and again because then it made it very easy for her to remember Krishna, and then Krishna would come to them to help them in these calamities. And when he would come, then they would see him and they would no longer see repeated birth and death. They'd become ecstatic. Actually become ecstatic in the most difficult circumstances. This last summer, you know, I was in Berlin, and the devotees asked me to give a seminar, and I saw that there were a lot of challenging circumstances there. There'd been a lot of upheaval, and devotees were really struggling. It wasn't a very well-manned temple. There was one devotee that stayed in the temple. Others came and went and did a little service here and there, but maybe not always so steady. So devotees were struggling a lot. And they asked me to give a seminar. And I thought of a title that seemed to be really appropriate for what was going on there. And I entitled the seminar the Transcendental Judo Seminar. Now, how many of you have ever been trained in martial arts? Anybody here? Okay. Was it jiu-jitsu? Karate? Okay. Anyway, I think probably all of you are aware of the principle behind jiu-jitsu. Like if an attacker is coming, let's say Bhakta Mark is about, he gets really upset because I've offended him by my class. And he comes up and he wants to punch me in the nose. But he doesn't know that I know jiu-jitsu. Because so his hand is hand, and he's really upset. He's really angry. So with full force, he's going at my nose. So because I'm expert at jiu-jitsu, I take that opposing force that's aimed to injure me, and I use it to flip Mark over. Okay? And he ends up a mess on the floor. He's trying to hurt me, but I turn it around. So a very, very common thing that the material energy, it's designed that way, dukkhalyam ashashvatam, to cause us some suffering. You know, this material world is designed like that. Why? You know, it's this Krishna weaningness of this false independent mood that's described here. So, I actually taught the first three lessons of the Nectar Devotion in the seminar. I kind of tricked them, you know, get them in the door. But then we got, you know, the third lesson is Kleshagni, freedom from distress. And what I do is also teach the process of dealing with distress in that lesson. and there's a very interesting verse that describes how actually when a devotee undergoes distress, it's a loving exchange with the Lord. It's actually the purport of one 9:19. Please write this down, because the next time you go into distress, it'll allow you to, I mean, it's inevitable. All of you are going to be in distressful circumstances, probably within the next 48 hours. I mean, you might get maha distressful circumstances. It might come, like, maybe on a yearly basis, or... 1:9:19, the purport. This is the passing of Bhishma Dev, next chapter here in the Bhakti Vaibhava course. And there's a description Prabhupada gives in the purporting of the different bhavs that Krishna has with his devotees. Mother Jashoda, you know, in Vatsalya Ras. You know, this is loving exchange that's going on in Arjuna and Sakya Ras. This is loving friendship. And then Prabhupada describes, and the tribulations that a devotee undergoes is another transcendental bhav with the Lord. Think about it. That's a pretty far out statement. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, he describes how Krishna puts a devotee in distress to deepen his devotion. Wow. So, now we understand, you know, from the purport of 10.14.8, that devotees are not under the laws of karma. Once they begin the practice of Uttama Bhakti, they're not under the laws of karma anymore. Krishna directly intervenes to remove the last vestiges of the enjoying spirit, the wanting to be independent of the Lord, to enjoy separately from Him. Okay, so this is Krishna coming in a very loving way. When I was, before I became a devotee, somehow or other, it was actually the minister of the church that my family attended when I was growing up. I never bought into Christianity, I have to admit. You know, Krishna kind of saved me, you know, for devotional service. I just never bought into it. But he gave me this book, and it was by, Rami, you'll have to help me, I don't speak French very well. Jean-Paul Sartre? Sartre, okay. Forgive me. Forgive my French operade. But he wrote a play. His existential philosophy actually was formulated during the Nazi occupation, the Nazi German occupation of France. And there were a lot of torturous kinds of situations, a lot of abusive behavior, and people were killed and beaten and all kinds of things. So he wrote this play, and the play was entitled No Exit. And the protagonist was in one scene after another where people were being incredibly cruel to each other, just super mean. And the last line of the play, spoken by the leading actor, was, "Oh, I see. Hell is other people." Okay, that was his conclusion. So, and you know, within the devotional framework, I would say that probably the most distressful circumstances that I've undergone, you know, were orchestrated by, you know, the agents of Krishna's mercy on me were other devotees. I mean, I have to admit, you know, there was, I'm sure I gave it to them and they gave it back. You know, we were the rough gems, you know, and the rough abrading surface, you know, we were tumbling around, you know, and abrading on each other. But there's a very interesting, another reference. This is 11.7.37, and this is Lord Krishna's instructions to Uddhava. And in this, there's a pastime of Maharaj Yadu inquiring from this avadut, who is incredibly transcendentally blissful, regardless of the circumstances that he was in. And he was just so inquisitive. Maharaj Yadu was saying, how are you so transcendentally situated? He couldn't fathom it. So then the avadut responded by saying that I have actually, in my life, I've had 24 gurus. And the first guru being the earth. And so this is 11.7.37. A sober person, even though afflicted by other living entities, understands that they are acting helplessly under the control of God. So, then you look at, okay, so some devotee's given me a really tough time. He's really hurt me. You know, I got scars all over my heart from his dealings with me. But he's actually acting helplessly under the control of God. And then we go back to 1.9.19, and this is a transcendental bhav with the Lord. Krishna's put me in this distress because he loves me. He wants to help me. Wants to help me overcome this false independent mood, ichadvesha samutvena, you know, to enjoy separately and to be envious of other living entities. And he gives us these powerful shastric references so we can understand that it's actually him, and we understand that it's him, and he's doing this out of deep love for us. If we really understand that, it becomes very blissful. Even the most distressful circumstances we experience some ecstasy. Okay, that's, you know, like in 5 minutes or less, you know, the idea behind transcendental judo. Okay, so how to turn, you know, these distressful circumstances by applying the philosophy, by understanding our position as tiny servants of Krishna, and understanding it is actually Krishna that's putting us into this circumstance because he loves us and he wants us to come back to him as soon as possible. He wants us to recognize that we're not such great people. We're a little bit rascals because we left his shelter. We're not dependent on him. He wants us to be dependent upon him and return to our natural position of being fish in water, where we can really enjoy on the transcendental platform, really be deeply satisfied and happy. Okay, now, I could go on and on, but I guess the point is, so we've got these qualities, we've got these characteristics that Krishna has given us, we should work super hard, we should move towards perfection in our service. Don't be lazy. It's just, I'm a devotee. I don't have to do anything. I just got to, you know, depend on Krishna. No, we work really hard. And then Krishna will guide us. He'll give us the intelligence of how to use our capabilities in his service very, very effectively. You see, the most advanced devotees, that's what they do. They're not lazy people. They're maxed out. And that avyarta kala tum, they're using every second of their lives in Krishna's service. Okay, so this is a devotional mood, and the subsequent translations, I've been instructed by Madhu Gopal that this is the way that's usually handled, this Bhakti Vaibhava lesson, that you just you deal with the verse in purport, and then you read the translations of the other verses. As the name and fame of a particular body is finished with the disappearance of the living spirit, similarly, if you do not look upon us, all our fame and activities, along with the Pandavas and Yadavas, will end at once. So again, this devotional mood of recognizing that any good things that I'm able to do, any characteristics, favorable characteristics, they're coming from you, Krishna. She's a very humble mood. But also realistically assessing what I've been given so that I can use it in Krishna's service. It's not this artificial humility. It's understanding this is Krishna's gift to me to use in his service. If I'm fully using it in his service, that's the epitome of humility. Not using anything for my own self-aggrandizement. O Gadadhar Krishna, our kingdom is now being marked by the impression of your feet, and therefore it appears beautiful. But when you leave, it will no longer be so. It's for a devotee, Krishna is his whole life. Anything that's good about it is because Krishna's there. He's present. Right? I mean, when devotees are happy and satisfied, they're feeling Krishna's presence. They're perceiving it. They're feeling it. And they're feeling the bliss of serving him. They know they've pleased him because the bliss is there. All these cities and villages are flourishing in all respects because the herbs and grains are in abundance. The trees are full of fruits. The rivers are flowing. The hills are full of minerals and the ocean full of wealth. And this is due, all due to your glancing over them. The Ishavasha principle. You know, the devotees, they don't take anything beyond their quota. They recognize it's all coming from Krishna. They're not worried. Shraddha Shabde Vishvashkahe Shudhida Nishchaya Krishna Bhakti Kale Savakarma Kritahoy. They have complete faith that Krishna is going to take care of all their needs. They don't worry about it. I mean, I've been devotee, what, like 36 years? I still got a little bit of a belly. You know, I don't starve to death. You know, everything's always been there whenever I've needed it, you know. And so we look at it. You know, we got a lot of protection. We got a lot of facility within ISKCON. And we have to understand it's coming from Krishna. And, you know, so we don't really have the anxieties that a materialist do, because they're thinking they're the doer. Prakrite kriyamanani, punai karmani savasaha. O Lord of the universe, soul of the universe, O personality of the form of the universe, please therefore sever my tie of affection for my kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. Now that seems a little contradictory, because, I mean, even better than serving Krishna is serving Krishna's devotees. So what Kunti is addressing here is, you know, this familial misconception. Serving the devotee, something, you know, after like, 23 years of grihastha life, I'm finally beginning to see my wife as a devotee. You know, it's really nice. You know, I can see that Krishna, and I'm dealing with her on that platform more so than being the wife. So there's a different kind of purifications that take place in the grihastha ashram, you know, to see and appreciate the devotional characteristics, you know, and serve the devotee, and not so much on the bodily platform. So this is what Kunti's aspiring for, you know, and sever that mundane misconception. Okay, so she's, you know, and then she went, O Lord of Madhu, as a Ganga forever flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being diverted to anyone else. Uttama Bhakti Ki Jai. So, I mean, this is, all these prayers focus us more and more into Anyabhi Lashita Sunyam Jnana Karma Yanavitam Anuku Yena Krishna Anu Shilamam Bhakti Uttama. So this continuous flow of bhakti, uninterrupted, it's indicative of the Uttama Bhakti platform. O Krishna, O friend of Arjuna, O chief among the descendants of Vishnu, you are the destroyer of those political parties which are disturbing elements on the earth. Your prowess never deteriorates. You are the proprietor of the transcendental abode, and you descend to relieve the distresses of the cows, the brahmanas, and the devotees. You possess all mystic powers, and you are the preceptor of the entire universe. You are the Almighty God, and I offer you my respectful obeisances. So Kunti ends with this kind of a summative glorification of Krishna. And then included in this series of verses is Krishna's initial response, which is in this next translation. Sutta Goswami said, the Lord, Thus, after hearing the prayers of Kunti Devi, composed in choice words for his glorification, mildly smiled. That smile was enchanting as his mystic power. So, there's a, you know, Krishna's obviously pleased. So, it's not just the quantitative service that we render. You know, sometimes devotees get this misconception. It's not the grade that we get, you know, at the Baitavanta College. It's not how many books we distribute or, you know, how many buildings we build or how much Lakshmi we collect. You know, what really is the most pleasing to Krishna is the devotional mood that we have. That's why Uttama Bhakti is so much emphasized by Rupa Goswami, you know, that we get into this mood of Uttama Bhakti. We're not doing it for ourselves, we're doing it to please Krishna. So this series of prayers, including what we covered today, that whole mood that Queen Kunti's enunciating is extremely pleasing to the Lord. So it's a mood, an attitude that we should also try to imbibe. Prabhupada, in the introduction to Nectar of Instruction, he describes how advancement in Krishna consciousness is dependent upon the attitude of the practitioner. So this is a very, very important part of our devotional service, the internal cultivation, the cultivation of dhanya, you know, I was hearing a class that the Prana gave at the manor, and he was referencing a class, maybe you can give us a reference, where Prabhupada described that the greatest austerity a devotee performs is being respectful to others. That's a very difficult thing. So a humble person, you know, he doesn't inflict distress on others. You know, he's respectful because he's feeling himself to be a servant of Krishna. Did I get it right? So we have to check ourselves. I go back to this reference from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. You know, if we understand that the main support for our devotional service is humility, then one should cultivate that. She could cultivate words, behavior, and thoughts that are in line with dhanya, this feeling of being utterly incapable and fallen. And this is a very significant mood. Okay, but I think I should stop here, because I'm a little past the cutoff time. The administrators aren't here, so when the cat's away, the mice can play a little bit. So I think we have time, because there's not so significant administrative heat being applied to me right now. Maybe there's some questions, comments, or chastisements. Madhu Gopal Prabhu? Can you start over again and speak a little louder? Well, that's also part of respecting. You know, it's pretty easy to see the spots on the moon. But when the spots become somehow or other, our vision is focused on it, then it would be very difficult to see the moon and have a respectful attitude. You know, that's where that instruction of the Avadhut to Yadu Maharaj is very significant. You know, that actually these devotees, they're very special people, and they're acting helplessly under the control of God, you know, when we're being inflicted somehow or other by their false egos. It's very challenging to do, but But that's what it takes to make spiritual advancement. We chant really good rounds. We have a humble mentality. We don't, you know, think about our latest conflict throughout our rounds and how we're going to get back at this guy. You know, there's another reference in this regard. This is 1848, and this is the Sringi, you know, in his glorification of Maharaj Pariksit, how he didn't take revenge. He didn't counteract the curse that Sringi, you know, this spaced out, you know, Brahmin boy, you know, he sees his father disgraced with the dead snake garland. And Maharaj Pariksit took it. You know, so there, Prabhupada says the devotee doesn't, no, actually it's a translation. 1848, the devotee, even though defamed, injured, hurt, even killed, I mean, after you're killed, it's pretty hard to take revenge, but I guess maybe next birth, but he doesn't take revenge. He doesn't try to counteract that. Because he can see, you know, he's got the vision, you know, and this comes from regularly studying Prabhupada's books and trying to, there's Shravan. These are the stages of Vedic knowledge realization. You quoted Nididhyasana yesterday in class, but Shravan, first you're here, and you try to understand intellectually. Then Manana, you're meditating on it, trying to see how you can apply it, you know, in your life, this personal application. Then Nididhyasana, the knowledge becomes one with you, it's realized. So we have to do this, we have to try and apply it. This is what's so good about the inquiry-based curriculums or the VTE methodology, student-centered learning. You know, the student is pushed to apply it. You know, to really use his brain, you know, manana, you know, to bring it into their whole frame of reference, you know, these Shastra conjunctions. Other points? Yes, Dina Dayal Prabhu. Okay. Yeah. Okay, when Krishna's personally present, then I missed. Yeah, the wayward cowbird boys, he couldn't fight them off when they were trying to take Krishna's queens. Well, no, that's true. You know, and Arjuna's, would you allow me to philosophically speculate to try and understand this? I mean, you know, there's legitimacy to philosophical speculation if it's used to come closer to Krishna. This is favorable to devotion. It's not, you know, beyond which is should be avoided. So, you know, these pastimes, very, you know, okay, so there's one thing, that the power that Arjuna had on the battlefield of Kurukshetra was because Krishna was there. You know, this is why the Pandavas, you know, they had, there's two kinds of power. There's, this is described in the Ram Lila pastime in the ninth canto, where, I don't know the verse, but it's the ninth canto, sorry. There's a description of Ravana's army that's comprised of monkeys that are recruited, Ravana's armies are professional soldiers with modern weaponry, whereas Ram's army are monkeys recruited from the jungles, and their weapons are sticks and stones. Okay, then in the purport, Prabhupada describes two types of power. There's Purushakara, and there's Daiva. Okay, now Purushakara is power derived from our own strength and intelligence. ultimately it's illusory. This is the power of the materialist, Ravana, right? And Daiva is derived from transcendence. I mean, Prabhupada was a perfect example of that. You know, 20 rupees in his pocket, 7 trunks of Bhagavatams, the holy name, and then he had 2 heart attacks crossing the Red Sea, and he comes to New York City, and he sold Captain Pandya, you know, a set of his Bhagavatams for $20, and that's the assets that he had when he came to the world. He had no support, had one contact, Zali Agarwal and her husband. And he persevered, he depended upon Krishna, and Krishna gave him unprecedented empowerment. Okay, and in this case, Prabhupada, you know, he said his spiritual master was always with him. And then when he was at Radha Damodar temple, Rupa Goswami came to him in a vision. And he said, Maharaj, just go to the West and preach. Don't worry about anything because I'll be right there with you. A very powerful experience for Prabhupada, that episode. So this is the inherent contradiction that you're seeing. You know, Prabhupada's example, he only had the personal, he had the Vapu association of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, I believe it was 7 times. But the instructions were so deep in his heart that it was always, he always felt so intimately connected with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So my understanding, you know, my philosophical speculation on this, that it was kind of a demonstration, you know, to maybe the less advanced, that Arjuna's power came from Krishna. You know, and then Krishna left, the power was removed. It wasn't that there was a reduction in intimacy in their relationship because he's an eternal associate. But just to demonstrate, you know, where power comes from. It comes from Krishna. More advanced platform, because, you know, well, look at the example of our movement. When Prabhupada was present, I joined when Prabhupada was present, and phew, man, was it ever fired up. I mean, sometimes, you know, I know there's a challenge, Maharaj, you know, like, I agreed I'd say Tani just before I left, he said the biggest challenge, you know, that ISKCON Radhadesh faces is a slackening of sadhana standards. That's from his point of view as a longtime leader. And but you know, I just to give you an example, when Prabhupada was present and he was coming to visit the 55th Street Temple, which is where I joined. And he was in London. His imminent arrival was like 2 weeks off. And there was a crew of devotees that were working 24/7 on his new quarters up on the 11th story. And, you know, even though they were up probably all night long, maybe slept an hour or two, they still came to the Bhagavatam classes. And I remember, I mean, it was 77. It was like 35 and a half years ago. I remember them standing in the back during the Bhagavatam class, and sometimes they would fall over asleep. You know, they fell asleep on their feet and fell on the floor, fell next on top of the person next to them. They were so tired. But you know, I was a Sankirtan devotee, and there was a rule that the Sankirtan devotees could not leave the temple room after Mangala Arati. They had to stay through and chant around them. You know, it was so strict. But it was so, I mean, I remember like chanting my japa with Pragosh, you know, the famous book distributor. And it was so intense, you know, and I'd walk around. And it was just like, you know, I was walking next to him and I felt like I was just floating around the temple room. It was just so powerful experience for me. And there, you know, they had these airbrushed paintings of Krishna's pastimes on the walls, you know, out of Krishna book. And it was as if it would just come alive. It was just so intense. But it was based upon, you know, like Prabhupada's presence, and he emphasized this so much, the standard of morning program. So it was easy to execute, because Prabhupada wanted it, and we were just here to please Prabhupada. Everybody was there, no matter what their varnic propensities or their spiritual event. They just knew this is what Prabhupada wanted. So, you know, a little bit churchianity is kind of entered in, you know, now. You know, like Maharaj's big austerity, try to, you know, get the Bhaktivedanta College. Isn't this a Bhaktivedanta College course? And we don't have so many students here. Anyway, I better keep my big mouth shut. You know, I'm getting probably too heavy here. But the point is that when Prabhupada left, there was a, you know, when he was present, 95% of the devotees in the temple with a brahmachari brahmachrini within 2 years, you know, there was like a wave of white, you know, so everyone switched to ashram. I mean, it was evident that there was so much dependent upon Prabhupada. And those that survived, you know, and I look now, you know, there were 250 devotees in that 55th Street temple, and there were 19 devotees that I took diksha from in the first initiation after Prabhupada. I'm the only one that's still active. And of those 250 devotees, very, very few I know where they even are now. So, you know, the Vapu Association is very significant, but we have to understand, you know, and this is what Queen Kunti, she's so worried about. What are you going to do when you leave us? What are we going to do? So this is, you know, this is an important devotional understanding. You know, this service and separation, you know, to really enter deep into the mood and mission of Srila Prabhupada, understand what he wants from us, understand what our spiritual masters want from us, and really give our hearts to it so that we don't become victimized, you know, when Vapu is not available by the material energy. Does that make sense? Does my philosophical speculation makes sense? I mean, it wasn't that Arjuna lost empowerment, but externally he did. There was, you know, he had still had such connection with Krishna. But to demonstrate, you know, what takes place, and it's historical. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur leaves, Gaudiya Maharaj, within a very short period of time, collapsed. You know, Prabhupada demonstrated his potency because ISKCON's gone on. We have to ensure, and this is the role of education, as far as I can understand, it's you know, the integrity with which Prabhupada wanted it to continue with, which is a high emphasis on sadhana, because if you take sadhana away from a Vaidhi sadhana bhakta, what you got left, not much. You know, and that's the vehicle that Krishna has given us, that Prabhupada's given us, to come to the higher stages of Krishna consciousness. And so it's so important to all of us, and it's an act of compassion of Yadunandan Swami to be a little strong with the Bhaktivedanta College students to come, because it really, the lights go on when we get this. And I have to admit, you know, that my last morning program up until January 25th was here at Radha Desh. It was the last morning program that I attended, because I was 7 weeks in bed. You know, the doctors, I went to this doctor and he tied my feet up and sent me back home by ambulance. And I had to stay in bed. I couldn't go to the temple. And, you know, you can't imagine. Like, you don't know what it's like not to walk until you don't walk. You know, we take it for granted. But when that was taken away from me, when those angas were taken away from me, whoo, man, was my mind all over the universe. It was much more difficult to control it. Much more difficult to stay focused. Much more difficult to experience a higher taste. So it's a very, you know, very, very essential for us as devotees. Okay, I see Yadananda Swami's eyes glance at the clock. This is my, he's a lightweight administrator, but I take that quite seriously. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna.